the idea was that what we called fantastic objects get created sometimes in the mind of investors, which promise much more than just money. It is, of course, money, but they are fantastic objects in the sense that Melanie Klein or someone like that might mean them. Things that if you possess are like magic.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org.
Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast. I'm Dr. Stephen Rolfe. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Corporate and Organizational Consulting. I'm managing principal of Rolfe Advisory and specialize in psychodynamic leadership advisory services for CEOs, business owners, and leaders in crisis. I'm pleased today to welcome David Tuckett from London. David is a fellow of the Institute of Psychoanalysis and currently professor and director of the Center for the Study of Decision-Making Uncertainty at University College London. As an undergraduate, he studied economics and politics with sociology at the University of Cambridge, during which time he became very interested in psychoanalysis. He went on to train as an analyst a few years after graduating and qualified with the British Psychoanalytic Society in 1977. Throughout his career, Professor Tuckett has worked part-time in private clinical practice while also conducting research in the fields of psychology, medicine, the social sciences, and more recently, economics. He has held positions at various academic institutions and taught sociology and psychology to medical students as part of their training. He was formerly president of the European Psychoanalytic Federation, editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, and principal of the Health Education Studies Unit at the University of Cambridge. In 2007, Tuckett won the Sigourney Award for his contributions to psychoanalysis. In 2011, he published his book, Minding the Markets, An Emotional Finance View of Financial Instability, and his current book in press is The Role of Conviction and Narrative in Decision-Making Under Radical Uncertainty, Theory and Psychology. David, welcome. I'm delighted to speak with you, and I hope in the time that we have together, we can provide a meaningful introduction to the body of your work and the trajectory of your career. As some in our audience know, your early clinical work and writing emphasized your pluralistic approach to questions of analytic theory and practice, leading you to publish in the year 2000 an article entitled Theoretical Pluralism and the Construction of Psychoanalytic Knowledge. And if I may, beginning in 2002, you led a six-year research project conducted by the European Psychoanalytic Federation, a working party on comparative clinical methods, the conclusion of which was published in 2008 and was entitled Psychoanalysis Comparable and Incomparable, The Evolution of a Method to Describe and Compare Psychoanalytic Approaches, the work that you did with Dana Bergsted Breen and Paola Mariotti and others. I understand that the purpose of this work was to increase communication between analysts working in different traditions. And it was an attempt to define what psychoanalysis is, and the work also involved assessing psychoanalytic competence. So I thought before we got into your current work, which has more to do with emotional finance and decision making, we could spend some time talking about the work that you did focused on pluralism, if you could say some about that and how that's important to your current work.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to you. So, yes, the European Comparative Clinical Methods Group has been going since 2004. Actually, it's still going. We produced a book in 2008 and we're just working on a second book now. The first book dealt with a new method of discussion, which tries to privilege trying to understand what the analyst is doing. And the second book will try to actually describe different ways psychoanalysts have of working. The basic principle is the idea that in psychoanalysis, there's a lot of confusion about basic concepts. So in 2002 in Prague, around 120 analysts came together in 10 groups and discussed in detail clinical material. Their task was to not try and think how they would have done the particular analyses being discussed, but to try and think how the analyst was actually doing it. So this fundamental principle was that you're trying to understand how another analyst works, rather than trying to tell them how they should work. So what we discovered very early on there was that of the 120 people present, for example, they had well over 120, perhaps 140 different ways of defining transference. And when it came to a transference interpretation, even more different ways. So what became necessary was to find a new method for having a discussion, which was free of existing terminology, though, of course, not free of existing theory. So we tried to differentiate the terminology from, that is, the word transference, from the different ways that word can be used. And over the last, must be 17 years now, we've been working on that method. That's the 2008 book describes the method. And we must have now analyzed something more than 200 cases. The cases are typically discussed by a group of 10 or 12 people for 12 hours or more, one case, only about two sessions. And the method orientates you towards asking for each thing the analyst does. For example, he makes an interpretation or she makes an interpretation. You try and think within the group, what is the purpose of that interpretation? And to help that thought, we give people five choices. This is a joke. It's not really that we think it's so simple as that, but we found in practice that if you give people choices about what it might be, they have a more rigorous discussion about it. And we then try and formulate people's way of working in terms of five core ideas. That is, the way an analyst thinks as to how a patient has come to be like he or she is. So this is kind of, if you like, psychopathology, but it's about what is the problem the patient presents and how has this problem come to exist? Because we find that actually, even at that very basic level, psychoanalysts tend to have very different ideas, for example, about how they think trouble in early childhood ends up with problems that people experience in the present. We also then look at the theory the analyst seems to have about how analysis is meant to work. For example, that you offer interpretations, or you interpret conflict, or you interpret the transference, or you try and create a facilitating environment, or whatever it is. We also look at the precise way, once they've got their theory, analysts try and sort of in each session say and do things to try and make that work. We look at the way analysts listen, and especially we're interested in what they think the unconscious material in a session is, and how do they get it, and what do they think, how do you know what a patient is talking about unconsciously? And finally, we look at something called the analytic situation, which is really the transference, but we call it the analytic situation for the reason I gave you. And it's trying to see how the analyst thinks the past, what happened to the patient in the past is present in the present. Because as you know, the fundamental theory that Freud had was that fortunately, we don't just have to talk about what happened in the past, but the past comes into the room, so to speak, in the present. But as soon as you've stated that, people have lots and lots of different ideas about how that happens. So the idea behind all this is to give up what I found quite a tiresome business among psychoanalysts, that whenever there is clinical material presented, a gang of people line up and tell the analysts how they should have done it better. Not necessarily having put themselves first in the analyst's shoes. So the first challenge of all this is we try to create this method whereby you try to think not what you would have done, but really what was that person doing. And this is in fact pretty difficult, and people don't quickly get to it, especially since, as you know, all clinical material raises a lot of feelings, and especially feelings when people get the impression the analyst isn't doing something that they think should be done, or the patient is, you know, desperately upset about something that the analyst isn't noticing. It all makes it a complicated thing to discuss. But what we try to do with this method is to provide a way of actually genuinely trying to see what different analysts do. And so in the group, there's an absolute hard and fast rule, is that whatever you may think privately, in the group, you must assume the analyst presenting is an analyst, is doing analysis, and the question is only how.
So if, for example, someone feels that a transference interpretation is not being made, that it's being completely missed, what do you do with that information?
Well, in the first instance, the person in the group keeps that to themselves, and they think they should try to treat that as, if you like, a bit like counter-transference, as a reaction they've had, and then to explore within themselves why they are wanting to be judgmental like that, and realize that they need to sit back a little bit further in their chair and ask themselves, well, hang on a minute, what is the analyst isn't making a transference interpretation, according to me, but what are they doing? And so listen to what the other group, the rest of the group are saying, perhaps ask the analyst some questions, although we try to make it so that it's a discussion between the group rather than with the group and the analyst, if you see what I mean. It's difficult to explain, but it does basically work. You know, you try and think about if the analyst has said something like, so you're anxious, to the patient. You try and think, why did the analyst say that there? What do we suppose they'd heard in the preceding bit of material that made them say it? How do we think that fits with the way the analyst is trying to explain us that they work, or what they think is the matter with the patient, and so on? And of course, although you discuss each individual interchange in a great deal of detail, ultimately you put it all together again and you look at, you know, the whole session or the whole number of sessions. The main difference is that instead of being preoccupied with the patient, you look at the analyst. And once you've done this, you will discover whenever you go to other meetings where people are discussing clinical material, that it changes the way you think. It's also very relevant to the evaluation that we sometimes have to do in psychoanalysis, for example, in training. Although people hate doing it, it doesn't make a lot of sense to qualify every single person who comes into the training. So there has to be some system for trying to think, has someone now learned how to do it? That also requires a focus on the analyst rather than the patient. But one of the experiences I had early on, when I was sitting on committees that had to do these kind of evaluations, I found that, in fact, people were very often talking about the patient rather than talking about the analyst, and rather than actually trying to think, well, what does the analyst doing that makes me think they are an analyst, or what are they doing which makes me think they aren't yet an analyst?
And again, this is all in the hopes of defining what analysis is, what the core ideas are.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I'd started to become interested in this when I was editor of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, as you know, because the interesting thing about the International Journal is you have papers coming from all over the world with very different approaches that the analysts have from very different cultures. And so the challenge is how to have a system for evaluating which papers to publish, which is kind of fair and rigorous. And this had already interested me in the problem of pluralism, because it's perfectly obvious to me that there were different approaches. And when during that time in 1999, I was asked to whether I would be willing to stand as president of the European Psychoanalytic Federation, the EPF, I had to give some thought to, so what's the point of an international organization like EPF, or for that matter, IPA? And one of the main points, surely, is that if people are coming together and spending their money to go to a conference, etc., we should be trying to create a situation where they exchange in the most useful and intelligent way possible, able to exercise their curiosity for what other people are doing. And yet so often the experience wasn't necessarily like that. So this CCM group and a number of other so-called working parties that I set up with the rest of my executive at that time were all ways of trying to improve the experience of psychoanalysts from different cultures working together. And this therefore led to trying to formalize pluralism, because pluralism was a great development in psychoanalysis. As I think one way of looking at the history is to say that it began in quite an authoritarian way, partly, I think, because Freud made a big mistake when he, if you remember, kicked out the first deviant, who was Adler, that instead of explaining to Adler and the rest of the Viennese society why he thought Adler was not doing psychoanalysis and why his approach wasn't psychoanalysis, which I don't think it was, by the way, instead he used his authority. And this then became the basis for numerous psychoanalytic societies, especially in North America, I think, where people used authority to shut people up who were saying things they didn't like, or et cetera, rather than to use real scientific debate. Now, scientific debate is always difficult in all disciplines, but it usually is, if it's done well, it's based on peer review, it's based on trying to give reasons for why you think things, and it's trying to be open and allow people to have open debate. And while psychoanalysis had lots of different terms and inventing new terms nearly every day, it didn't really have a good culture for discussion. So this was something that Arnie Cooper and I were interested in, especially with the International Journal, that spread out with Jean-Michel Kinnadeau and Jorge Almada to Europe and Latin America, and really has been part of my interest all this time. How do you, in psychoanalysis, which is such a subjective and emotional and complicated discipline, have serious debate so that you can actually say, no, that approach actually doesn't seem to work, or isn't right, or, you know, whatever you want to say. You have to make judgments in the end, because otherwise we accept everything. And one of my papers that was quite well known was called Does Anything Go? This is actually a joke that came to me after I watched the famous musical Anything Goes.
Right.
But my sense was that in a certain way, psychoanalysts surely don't think anything goes, because that would be crazy. What would be the point of having training standards or anything? And yet we didn't really have very good procedures for managing then, if you don't have anything goes, what does go? And it seemed to me clear that given that there were different approaches, you had to have some system for working out what didn't go, so to speak, according to those different processes. When we tried to look into that, it turned out that this was all very implicit and, again, suffused with authority rather than reasons and arguments. And so, you know, in that paper, we tried to set out some ways in which this can be approached. And I think nowadays, many psychoanalysts societies are thinking about this, although there are also some fairly disturbing trends, such as quite a bit of opposition to any kind of evaluation, quite a bit of paranoia about evaluation, getting rid of training analysts, which I think is pretty lunatic, but getting rid of them because of concerns about power and authority and that the evaluation system doesn't work fairly.
So could you speak some to the core ideas that then came out of this work and how you really think about the core ideas of analysis?
So in doing all this, you are repeatedly forced to think, well, what are the core ideas of psychoanalysis? And where I would start from is I think our core idea is that thoughts are always suffused with feelings. Or to paraphrase John Rickman, you're not able to think anything that you can't feel the consequences of thinking. So, for example, if I feel like murdering you, I won't be able to really think that, I mean, properly, rather than just make a casual remark about it, unless I can actually tolerate somewhere in my mind, you know, actually doing that and envisaging the consequences, if you say it to me. Now, that's an extreme example. But in general, I think we would say that patients suffer from not being able to think about things that are causing them enormous anxiety, and that in a free association process in an analysis, they're sort of touching on thoughts that if the thought became fully conscious, would make them feel uncomfortable. So this essentially is Freud's concept of resistance. And I believe that resistance is one of the absolutely crucial concepts of psychoanalysis, but not resistance as understood as being negative towards one's analyst or analysis or anything like that, but simply resistance to the next thought that one has in one's mind. So Freud's patients, you know, when they were associating, they didn't like going certain places in their mind. That was resistance. And of course, as you know, Freud came to see that resistance wasn't something to be beaten down, but was absolutely something vitally important, almost gold, to think, the patient is resistant to some ideas. This gives me a crucial idea about which ideas are producing trouble in this patient's mind, and this is what I've got to start becoming interested in. So crucial, this business of for psychoanalysts, that thoughts and feelings are interwoven. Secondly, linked to that, the notion of resistance. And of course, in talking about resistance, you immediately come to the word unconscious. And I, of course, mean they're dynamic unconscious. And the point is that some thoughts have to be kept unconscious, because if the implications are conscious, the feelings that go with them are intolerable. So guilt feelings or envy feelings or even sometimes loving feelings in inappropriate situations. And then, of course, we go from there to fantasy and to unconscious fantasy in particular, which is simply a way of stating unconscious in a more meaningful way, that you have a fantasy always of what you would like to do to someone or what they would like to do to you. And these fantasies are very often unconscious because the feelings associated with them are anxiety provoking. From there, you get to all the classic ideas of psychoanalysis, and the most important one being the Oedipus complex and its various manifestations, including the primal scene. Also, the whole issue of how people negotiate feeling helpless or small, which is connected, of course, to the Oedipus complex, and which includes things like differences between the sexes and stuff like that, a difference between the generations. And then I think finally, what also very important, what Melanie Klein called the paranoid schizoid and the depressive positions, but really it is a question of how people manage ambivalence. And of course, we again mean unconscious ambivalence. And the depressive position being a situation where you can begin to tolerate feelings of guilt or responsibility or concern for the thoughts or feelings or actions that you've actually had, instead of having to keep them unconscious and be persecuted by them. So those are some of the key ideas that I think exist in psychoanalysis, and they're absolutely crucial for any clinical work, that you hear the Oedipus complex and the infantile sexuality in the material, that you sense the patient's unconscious thoughts, that they're difficult, they find difficult to speak, that you sense unconscious fantasies, etc.
Thank you, Dave. So if I may, you at some point took these core ideas, core concepts from analysis, and took them to help you to think about other problems in the outer world related to finance and banking. And maybe you could speak to how that transition occurred and how you make use of these concepts in your work.
So way back in 1969, when I was finishing up a degree in economics at King's College, Cambridge, I met, partly because in those days we did learn some sociology and psychology in economics, which you wouldn't now, a man called R.D. Lang, who was a psychoanalyst of the British Psychoanalytic Society, but also someone who was enormously well known for his writing and innovative thinking at what was quite an exciting time, 1968 and all that, if you were a student. I, at that time, quite naively, with no idea, this wasn't what one normally did, thought that, you know, the next thing to do would be to be a psychoanalyst. I was 21 at the time. And I won't go into all that, but I did become a psychoanalyst. In fact, I'd qualified when I was age 29 in the British Society. And of course, then I pursued simultaneously a career actually in sociology, medical sociology, and in psychoanalysis for a number of years. I got to edit the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, as we discussed. And through that, we ended up creating what is now known as PEP Web, which is the archive of all these psychoanalytic journals and many books and so on. But back in 1997, PEP was only a CD product. Somehow, some venture capitalists in London working for one of the big investment banks got to hear of this, came through my door, so to speak, here where I'm speaking to you now, in essence, wanted to buy PEP. And they offered a lot of money. They offered something like £4 million. And a contract for me of a lot of money to keep it going. The only problem was that I couldn't understand, and Peter Fonagin, the others who were involved, couldn't understand quite what was going on, because these people, they were experts financiers, but they didn't know anything about the internet. They didn't know anything about psychoanalysis, and they didn't know anything about publishing. But they had the idea that they would turn PEP into a .com. And you may remember that this was the time of .com, what became .com mania. So we, in fact, it would have been enormously complicated to have got the British and the American, who ultimately owned PEP, to agree to this in any case, even if we thought it advisable. But we said no to them. And when about 15 months later, the entire stock market collapsed, the dot-com bubble burst, so to speak, I became extremely interested. And by now, I'd managed to integrate some of my sociology into psychoanalysis in the stuff about which we've been talking about earlier. But I now thought I somehow could integrate economics as well. So I became interested in financial bubbles. I wrote a paper about it, which eventually appeared in the International Journal, in which the idea was that what we called fantastic objects get created sometimes in the mind of investors, which promise much more than just money. It is, of course, money, but they are fantastic objects in the sense that Melanie Klein or someone like that might mean them. Things that if you possess are like magic. You know, so in psychoanalysis, we would think of how the penis as a phallus can be thought like that, or how the breast can be thought like that. And of course, we have very good understanding of the fact that this kind of inducing strong emotions of that kind help the attachment process and are kind of fundamental to the early life of all of us. But fantastic objects, when applied in adult life to treating shares on the stock market as if they are fantastic, like genies who can wave a wand and give you whatever you want and so on, is another matter. But the more I looked into, and there I worked with a finance professor, Richard Taffler, the more we looked into contemporary descriptions of dot-coms and so on, the more we were struck that what was being described unconsciously were fantastic objects. And then, of course, the trajectory of a bubble, which goes up, 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 and then falls very rapidly, is, of course, the trajectory of a manic depressive state. So we became interested in this and set out a theory of bubbles, which developed this concept of fantastic objects, suggested that people in this situation, investors, were developing an internal fantastic object relationship to these things, and that they were able to do this because they were engaging in splitting, that is, you would say to a psychoanalyst, in a paranoid schizoid, more state than depressive. But because that particular term caused a lot of trouble when it was used outside psychoanalytical circles, and once there was a headline in the Times actually saying, "Professor says all investors are schizophrenic," which is not my belief. I altered it actually in discussion with Mervyn King, who was then the governor of the Bank of England. So I now talk about divided states, which is the paranoid schizoid, and integrated states, which is Melanie Klein's depressive position. And that's kind of stuck. And then obviously also in the process of finance, there was groupthink going on. Anyway, this work got some interest. I mentioned Mervyn King. He read the paper and thought it was very interesting. And as a result of which, a few years later, I was awarded a Leverhulme Fellowship to investigate what seemed to me to be the question, which is, how does a normal market, as understood in economics, develop into one of these bubble type markets? And to do that, I interviewed 52 of the world's leading investors, some in Scotland, in London, in New York, Philadelphia, and Boston. This led eventually to the book, Minding the Markets, in 2011, where I set out this so-called theory of emotional finance, in which the idea is to understand finance as continuously involving these internal object relations, potentially to fantastic objects, but not always fantastic objects. The idea being that financial markets are different to other markets. In a market for cars or houses, you know, when you buy it, you buy a real thing. Now, with houses, it gets a little bit marginal, but if we keep it with cars or televisions, when you buy the car, you know, after you've bought it, you've got a car, you can use it, you can drive it, etc. It deteriorates, and if you don't like it anymore, you can sell it. But it is a sort of concrete thing. Similarly, more or less with a house. But with a financial instrument, in fact, all financial instruments are simply debt contracts. They're promises to be paid something or other at some future time. And those promises are entirely uncertain. You have to imagine what the promises will actually produce. As a result, when you value a financial object, the valuation is continuously subject to change. It's continuously subject to the question, what would someone else pay for it? It doesn't have any intrinsic value, or if it does, it's very minimal. So investment objects continuously have to be attached to processes of imagination, which are then subject to all the things that we psychoanalysts know about and which I had outlined already in relation to the dot-com. The other main point is that because I was studying professional investors, because of uncertainty about future values, how do people then manage to hold share, you know, to buy them, to take the risk that you're buying something which could fall in value? And the way they do that is by imagining that the thing is going to go up, it's going to be very attractive, it's going to be profitable, and so on. and somehow subduing the anxiety that it might lead to a loss. Now, clearly, this whole system is therefore continuously open to going wrong. And that's what this book sets out, that the market can easily move from perhaps more or less valuing things in what seems like a plausible way. But because there's fundamental uncertainty, you can never know what the true value is. And so it's very subject to these effects, you know, fantastic objects and so on.
Just to understand this further, you then began applying this kind of theoretical understanding to work with institutions. And I'm wondering if you could give an example of how this works, of how the work with consulting to organizations or institutions works.
This so-called emotional finance theory did attract attention, and quite a few finance houses became interested in it. I mean, they're mainly interested at a level of tell us all about it, and we tell them all about it, and they try and make sense of it. But some have tried to develop their own ideas in it. But mainly what I've done is move to a more general area of understanding not just financial decision-making, but any kind of decision-making, substantial decision-making under uncertainty. And I've extended the work I've just told you about to look at the way academics have understood decision-making, particularly in cognitive psychology, but also in other areas like economics, and have developed something called conviction narrative theory. And this is essentially a theory which says to make any decision under uncertainty where loss is potentially involved, what has to be done is that you have to develop conviction, that is a feeling that this is going to be profitable rather than it's going to be lose you money. Because unless we're in a perverse situation, nobody does any of this stuff with an intention to lose, right? So conviction narrative theory has been linked up with all kinds of psychological research. I think you can see how it's a profoundly psychoanalytic theory in its formulation. And I've been leading actually the UK's Decision Under Uncertainty Network, which is set up by the UK Research Councils to provide assistance to businesses and government. And there I'm working with physicists and sociologists and psychologists and statisticians and economists and numerous other people. And we've been going into organizations, for example, the Cabinet Office here, which is like equivalent to the White House kind of thing, where, you know, they have difficult decisions and they're interested in being helped to think about, make difficult decisions. If you look on the CRUSS website, it's CRUISSE. Our network is called Confronting Radical Uncertainty in Science, Society and the Environment. You will find a list of these of the projects we've done to try and help different organizations. But in addition, the main thing I've also been doing is working with the Bank of England. So, as you know, post the 2008 crisis, which of course created a lot more interest in my work than there had been before, the bank has, like the Fed and the other institutions, have been interested in how to spot financial instability before it actually happens. So I've been consulting with the bank in various ways and giving talks about that and helping them to understand these principles. And then most recently, I've been doing a research project which is investigating how the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee works. So that's the equivalent of the Federal Open Markets Committee. Anyway, the group that set interest rates in the US. This has been a study I've done with an anthropologist from the US called Douglas Holmes, in which we've been interviewing the people who make these decisions. Plus, we've been going with Bank of England officials to meetings with businesses throughout the UK, hearing about the way businesses are going and what they're doing, and looking at how the bank take that information and use it to make their decisions. Because, of course, the decision the Monetary Policy Committee is making is a decision under uncertainty. And according to me, therefore requires what I've called a conviction narrative. even though current economics doesn't have uncertainty really in the theory. Presently, economics doesn't deal properly with uncertainty. It is able to cast people as rational because they work out how people are supposed to behave in models. And of course, in a model, you can make somebody behave however you like. You just write the correct equation, right? And there's a fundamental difficulty, I think, in economics that it hasn't come out of model land, as I would put it, my colleagues would put it, into the real world. In the real world, you aren't given information about how the economy is working. You have to find it. You have, in fact, to construct it. Just as in deciding whether to invest in a .com, in the real world, you aren't told how much a .com is worth. You've got to work it out. The same with the Monetary Policy Committee. They actually have to develop a conviction narrative, and then they have to sell it to the public as well. And so the kind of ideas that I've been interested in become relevant as to understanding these processes.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for giving us an introduction to your work. We'll have the references that you mentioned, as well as your most recent work, available to everyone on the website ipaoffthecouch.org. I know we could only touch on all these different aspects of your work, but I really appreciate your spending this time with us today. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.